First, I'd like to thank Ben for asking me to speak, but also Ingrid for her paper, and for her example of speaking as a poet. This is the approach I'm going to take today, though I too share the caveat that any illumination can only be partial and imprecise. I feel like I could add so many other caveats, so please just whatever you can think to put down. Go with that. I do hope, though, that it is useful to think about the process of language in this poem, and I hope if it is useful that that will partially derive from my own naivety, because I feel that I have only very recently begun to think through what it means to write an Australian poetry, and my question, Ingrid talked about the question that animated writing about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Really has to do with that and an ambivalence. She didn't read the poem that with the I cannot love my country, but this ambivalence, it feels I cannot love my country with some of its history and I must love my country. I think it's telling that my favourite text of exploration of Australia is that written by John Price, Governor Hunter's servant sent to accompany an early convict foray. He writes things like, "The rest of the ground run very scrubby, and the country still rocky and scrubby." I feel sympathy with such descriptions because they reveal the state of encountering something new and yet having no language for it. Thinking about Ingrid's focus on the contemporary concerns raised by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa drove me backwards to the beginnings of white settlement in Australia and before, and to the urge for expansion, for conquest, for domination that led us here. I've been interested in how poetic thinking might help me understand those origins and where they have since taken us. As such, I want to contemplate a poem that looks back to discovery, to claim, and I'm also taking Ingrid's lead in addressing my own work, specifically The Queen's Ocean. I feel like it's a strange choice, as the central figure of this poem is the French Queen Marie Antoinette, but I hope this will become clearer. In thinking about origins, I found myself thinking about the attitudes and interests in this place, Australia, that was on the minds of many people in Europe, though they would never see it at the time of discovery. This place was translated for them in the words of its witnesses, making Australia an idea place they could inhabit in the imagination. In taking this poem as my central talking point, I find that I'm focusing specifically on its English, an English that keeps pulling away from Latinate and French influences and towards the Anglo-Saxon. I'll also say that my decision to address the beginnings of European settlement in Australia in my poetry came after work on the American Southwest. My second book, Ephemeral Waters, which is coming out really soon, takes as its subject the Colorado River, in which I found myself juggling geological history, white exploration, white migration history, multiple Native American histories, technological development, and my own experience as a visitor, an outsider, all the while overwhelmed by the impossibility of creating anything truly comprehensive. I think of the poem as incorporating documentary elements, and this documentary angle is something I'm working towards in new work. But I mention Ephemeral Waters too because I feel that though it is an American poem, it is paradoxically the work in which I began to think about Australia. And I want to mention too some of the poets who have influenced my thinking and practice when considering Australia in my own work. And I'm really grateful to Ingrid and John for providing a new reading list of poets outside Australia that I get to look up. But the English poet Alice Oswald, the Americans Susan Howe, Dan Beachy Quick, and Eleni Sakelianos. Of course, there are many Australians. Very recently, Emma Jones, Jennifer Maiden, and John Mateer have had a particular impact on me. So what both the historian and the poet face is the process of selection. For the poet, that selection is much more radical, as the poem is rarely the length of the historical monograph. Recall Emily Dickinson. Tell the truth, but tell it slant. That slant telling is another version of selectivity, or similar to Ingrid's interest in the edge of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The word also recalls her slant rhymes, the disruptions that keep jolting the reader away from her expectations and into the idiosyncratic world of the poet herself. I suppose then that the task for the poet in dealing with historical subjects is to tell the history, but tell it slant, to both take a perspective that is off kilter and to jolt herself and her readers through craft, that word again, in such a way that neither the poem nor the history proceeds quite as they expect. While I've become fascinated by the texts of explorers, I've also, at least equally, grown fascinated with the accounts of their reception back home in Europe. For instance, Samuel Johnson's disbelief at such a creature as the kangaroo existing, gathering his coat about him and then bounding across the room at a dinner party to prove its ridiculousness. Or, for instance, Marie Antoinette bursting into tears at court when, years after the fact, the news of Captain Cook's death finally reached court. Years later again, waiting for the guillotine, the Queen reading the explorers' journals, which had very quickly been translated into French and had become her favourite book. And yet she herself never saw the ocean while she was fascinated by the expanding globe. Writing about this occurrence seems like another way to reenact and re-memory, to use Ingrid's words, the process of settlement, to take the perspective of the outsider and work forward through subsequent poems. So the poem arising out of this small fact, the Queen's Ocean, canters through Marie Antoinette's arrival in France, her time at court, and her own hameau, sorry, my French pronunciation is terrible, and the stripping away of her name and her seclusion in Paris's conciergerie, awaiting her death. While it moves through those periods, it dwells on the contrast of her own untraveled experience and her fascination with Captain Cook's wide traversal. I'll read the central section of the poem. Remember the day the news arrived at court? Cook, the voyager, dead. The sudden salt tears shed for hours spent pondering the globe a mere queen could not traverse. Grief lagged, nipped at the far-off corpse a full year later when the report came through, and lingered later still as she pulled the volume of his explorations closer in her tower. Now known only by number, prisoner 250 let the familiar words once more swim before her eyes. In the PM, hoisted out the pinnace and yawl in order to attempt a landing, but the pinnace took in water so fast. All that water. Though I do not indicate it, the embedded quotation comes from the portion of Cook's journals during which the Endeavour hugged Australia's east coast, just off Jervis Bay. There are many segments of the journals that I could have quoted, but finding a small segment from the Australian entries reflected my own interest in European interest in the new land, also reflects the discovery for which Cook is most well known, arguably. Most important to making the move a success, the cadence of the language had to be markedly different from that of the rest of the poem, which I hope it is. Cook's language was in his own matter-of-fact style, and that is why I wanted to include his voice, the voice of the age of discovery, that contributed both so much to knowledge and so much carnage. I'm interested in the contrasting voices of explorers and the way they reflect different ways in which they were open to knowing the lands in which they found themselves. I'm also interested in thinking through how much their style may contribute to the way in which early settlers saw the land and its inhabitants and how that affects us still today. We know that a phrase like Marcus Clarke's weird melancholy can hang in the air for a long time. In the Queen's Ocean, the explorer's cool style is perhaps also echoed in my unadorned account of his fate. Cook, the voyager, dead. The word voyage, of course, enters into English from Old French. After I've written a poem, it has all but settled. I sometimes go back and look at the etymologies of the words I've used. During the act of writing, the way forward is only by intuition and listening to the poem. But over time, a certain balance of language is found. And I've become especially interested in the balance of Germanic and Latinate language in poems, and the presence of other words swept into our various Englishes, how much those balances may reflect the place that English is spoken. I think of this balance both as part of the signature of a poet, but also as a way of thinking about the version of English spoken and how they came to be spoken. When I look back at the Queen's Ocean, that tug between the two background languages is evident from the outset. There is the aqua aquamarine, straight from the Romans. There is sea green, words that would not have looked strange to the Beowulf poet. Reading the poem now, I see this journey played out in miniature a number of times. Describing the doomed queen's arc, I used the words opulent, then simple, then become the widow Capet. Opulent from Latin, simple from Old French, widow, another Anglo-Saxon word. Even in the citation from Cook's journals, the same tension exists. Pinnace, a French word, yawl, Germanic. After all that water, the poem repeats, all that water risen above a tower. I didn't know it in writing the poem that the word tower has been with us since Old English, then tor, and was reinforced by the French word tour. I dwell on etymology because I believe that the choice between a Germanic or a Latinate word is a vital part of craft, albeit something that poets are rarely conscious of in the act of writing and that critics rarely focus on. That Germanic language, the base language that gives us God and house and sleep and eat and drink and shit and fuck, lies at the core of our basic vocabularies of wants and needs. When Marie Antoinette is lowered from queen to prisoner, I play out her fate in the English language by a shift in diction. That shift in diction links back to Australia too, in that as the queen sits in her prison tower of the conciergerie, she is thinking of the discoverer of this place that is in the process of becoming a vast prison, complete with several executioner's blocks. I'm also particularly aware that this diction as Australian loader, of this diction as an Australian writer, because it is politically loaded. The less, it's a class distinction, the less education, the smaller your vocabulary, the smaller the English vocabulary, the more it is weighted towards the Anglo-Saxon. This is historically interesting because most of those transported as convicts weren't educated, and it is troubling too because language barriers within English are still very much present today. What at a time of settlement signifies a class divide becomes, as many groups begin to share a language, a race divide as well. If we return to a poem touched upon yesterday, the Anglo-Saxon bias in a smaller English can be seen in Ajuru's No More Boomerang. She negates the Aboriginal words absorbed into English. No more boomerang, no more corroboree, no more gunya, bunyip, he finish. And inhabits an English that mimics the expectation of limited language. The heaviness of the Anglo-Saxon is striking, and those Latinate words, civilized, and the abstract of abstract art seem even more ridiculously white and elite when contrasted with the Germanic roots. As such, thinking through writing as a settler, I find that I have to face both Australian history and Australian English. Though, as I already mentioned, I'm not actively thinking of etymology while I write, it has been important to me for a number of years. It's an inheritance from my teacher, Chris Wallace Crabb, who is also very interested in what an Australian English is. And I can't shake it. I don't particularly want to. And I hope that that focus opens up another element of craft that engages, as Ingrid put it, the way in which the settler conditions determines the literary thinking of its writers. I feel I must note that the moment quoted from Cook's journal comes as the Endeavour sitting off Jervis Bay. What follows reads, at this time, we saw several people ashore. He imagines the natives he sees with their boats are going to put into the water in order to come off to us. They don't, and they quickly disappear. That disappearance in Cook's text is an omission in my own, and this omission is something I must dwell upon. Each time I approach the shoreline, I find myself overwhelmed with the massiveness of what it is to set foot on the land inhabited by another and declare it empty. But this does not excuse omission. The only thing I can return to is the impossibility of comprehensiveness and the fact that each poem may instead offer a piece of a mosaic of witness. That in time, as I come to know my own country a little more, I may build up that mosaic. All that water. This is not just the Queen's unseen ocean, But the rising tide, as the world map becomes filled in, the explorers and scientists pushed into the previously unknown oceans and landscapes. And as they do, the tide of brutality rising. The Queen's fate at the hands of the people is public, while the Indigenous population's fate at the hands of the Crown remains so often hidden. All that water. The poem is oblique, probably too oblique, but it is the starting point I have been able to find that allows me to try to chart a course forward in time that I hope will avoid what Ingrid has warned us of, predictable fixed positions in cliched language with occasional feel-good Oprah-like flourishes, and that I hope will enable me to think through the settlers' relationship to this land and all the cruelty and misunderstanding that entails the recovery of the invisible. I'll end with the words of Eleni Sikelianos from the California poem. Now, to let go what we knew, to not be tight, but Tony, to find a world, a word we didn't know. Thank you.